Atlanta Athletic Club, a history, written by Charles Eliot in 1973. Chapter 2. AAC began to flex its muscles early in life. It was scarcely into the process of adjusting to its original home before it woke up one morning and found its membership growing out of proportion to the space available for both its physical and social functions. Not even the organizers had anticipated that their club would be so popular or a membership so desirable. Each applicant was carefully screened by the committee set up for that purpose, and for one reason or another, a certain percentage had to be turned down. In the city, however, were scores of young businessmen who recognized the importance of daily exercise for physical fitness. They were also aware that the social prestige of belonging to such a club as AAC was a powerful asset to their businesses and careers. And so, the organization expanded far beyond the dream of its founders. AAC had been in existence for less than 2 years when its officers and directors knew it was time to plan for the future. For flexibility and growth, the first requirement was more space. A diligent search failed to turn up any suitable location, and the logical solution appeared to be in a new building, one large enough to accommodate the total allowable resident membership of 700, with greatly expanded recreational facilities, both in number and in variety. In 1901, the club purchased a vacant lot on Auburn Avenue, and in November of that year commissioned architects Bleckley and Tyler to draw up plans for a super sumptuous athletic club building that would house every possible convenience and game space the club could ever want or need. In addition to the regular gymnasium with all the equipment, space was provided for a swimming pool, basketball and handball courts, an indoor track, pool tables, and even a bowling alley. The locker room was substantially enlarged, and the bath and shower system made more than adequate. Building took more than a year. One of the finishing touches was the addition of pool tables and construction of sectional double bowling alleys, which were contracted in two jobs, one to E.D. Sharkley Jr., who laid the base of dry cinders and 5 inches of concrete for $448, and the other to Brunswick Balk Collender, who laid the maple flooring. Charges for this job, plus the pool tables, was $1,025, for which the club paid $425 at completion and 6 monthly installment payments of $100 each. 4 new, improved tennis courts were constructed at Auburn. The new clubhouse was ready and AAC moved in on November 27, 1902. Tennis remained the most popular game, but it began to have competition with other sports. Some of the old-timers who were around when the compilation of this history began say that the Atlanta Athletic Club had a very excellent swimming team, and over the years won many events with schools and other athletic clubs in and out of the city. Softball also was supposed to be one of the major sports. And in the Auburn Avenue gym, the first physical director, Dr. Theodore Topel, developed an indoor track team that competed in many events. All of this is word of mouth, passed down by older members. There are very few records of athletic competition by the various teams in those earliest days of AAC. Most complete, perhaps, is the story of the basketball team, which originated on the hardwood floors and under the nets at Auburn and lasted through a quarter of a century or more, to end in a series of championship teams. In its last 6 years, from 1925 through 1930, basketball existed as one of the major sports at AAC, and the teams won 64 out of 74 games on the club's schedule. In those latter years of its existence, the basketball team must have been more orthodox than at the beginning. Over the seasons, the development of the players came from inter-club competition, and the basketeers grew so proficient that the team still stands as one of the all-time great squads in the South. John W. Heisman came along about that time. He was later the founder of the Heisman Football Trophy, for the best college player in the nation each year. There's more about him later in this book, but at the time he was Georgia Tech's first full-time football coach. In 1908, he was employed by the club as its first physical director and basketball coach at a salary of $75 a month. As one of the old-timers who was a star athlete in those days reported about Heisman, quote, "He didn't know a thing about basketball when he took the job, but in the first month he had learned more than the rest of us put together." The basketball squad took on college teams, other athletic squads, and anyone else who would play them.
It was a rough outfit at first, the old-timer recalled. One of our guys was a noted football player at Georgia Tech. We had a boxer on the team and a professional wrestler. They used to knock opposing players left and right. The referee didn't call many fouls in those days. May have been because he was afraid to. You had to hit a man with your fist or knock him down and step on his head or almost kill him in some other way before they called a foul on you. There was one game we played with Birmingham Athletic Club. The Birmingham boys were our most bitter rivals. That affair looked more like a free-for-all fight than a basketball game. The main object was to lay them out, and we sure did a good job of that. We shook them up so bad that Vanderbilt, a mild little college team, beat them the next night. Sometimes the aftermath of a story is as good or better than the original account. As witness this intriguing scrap of history that came to us in a most unusual way. In the late 60s, one of the Pinkerton guards working at the club handed the manager a medallion he had picked up on a beach near San Juan. The inscription on the medal showed it had been presented by the Atlanta Athletic Club to one Bill Dyer of U of C in 1923. The manager checked through his available club records but could find no mention of a Bill Dyer. Concluding that U of C could only mean the University of Chattanooga, he wrote to that institution for any enlightenment they might be able to give him. The manager's letter was turned over to the University Alumni Association, which came up with the report that William Dyer was indeed a member of the U of C basketball team, which went to the finals of the 1923 Southern Intercollegiate Athletic Association, sponsored by the Atlanta Athletic Club. A page from the University of Chattanooga 1923 annual gives us this account. With 6 minutes left to play, and the score 19-11 in Mercer's favor, Bill Redd, the team captain, called his chickens around him, and a different team finished the game, making 13 points during the last minute, while Mercer had to be satisfied it was not more. Mississippi A&M won the championship of the South by defeating the U of C Moccasins in the finals. The sports editor of the Chattanooga Times heard about the medal and published an account of it in his column. This brought a note from Mrs. Ruth Dyer Brawley of Chattanooga, saying that she had been Bill Dyer's sister and that he had lost his life in an automobile accident in 1926. AAC presented Bill Dyer's medal to Mrs. Brawley, and the case was closed with only one mystery unsolved: how the medallion found its way to a San Juan beach, and how it lay there on the sands of time, undiscovered for more than 40 years. There's no record that the first clubhouse on Edgewood Avenue had a telephone. Old contracts indicate that on December 4, 1902, Southern Bell installed a special line metallic circuit telephone station at our Auburn Avenue premises. The charge for this was $5 a month. That phone must have had plenty of use, because on August 28, 1903, a duplex line was added at the rate of $3 more a month. And on September 14th of that year, another special line was put in for $4 a month. Inflation was already beginning to rear its ugly head. On December 12th of that same year, the Western Union Telegraph installed a synchronized self-winding clock for accurate time service at a price of $12 per year. August 10th, 1904, another special phone was put into the clubhouse with a charge of $3.63 per month. But the contract specified that it could be used for only 121 local calls a month, and each call had to be 5 minutes or less. It seems that some of the members were beginning to find out what a telephone was all about. In 1904, an extension telephone desk set was installed on February 1st for $1.50, and the next July, a $3-a-month phone with 100 calls allowed was added. Southern Bell was on its way. Our club remained housed on Auburn Avenue for almost 24 years. During that time, we had 8 presidents, all important citizens in the young and vigorously growing city of Atlanta. These, with other successful businessmen prominent in the affairs of the city, contributed to the welfare and the expansion of the club. Some men, like G.W. Adair, W.H. Glenn, Robert P. Jones, J.H. Porter, B.M. Grant, Henry Hines, B.E. Thrasher Jr., and Scott Hudson served the club for many years. There were many others. The list is just too long. George Adair was president for 6 years between 1905 and 1911. and was one of the motivating forces of the Atlanta Athletic Club before, during, and after those years. Adair came from a long line of distinguished Georgians, and the name is synonymous with the growth and expansion of Atlanta. His father was born in Morgan County in 1823, and 2 years later his parents moved to a DeKalb County farm on South River, about 5 miles southeast of Decatur. Before he got into the real estate business in Atlanta, George Adair Sr. went through a variety of jobs and businesses, which ranged from clerking in a grocery store to studying law. He was admitted to the bar in 1844, and being a conductor on a passenger train. In 1854, he opened a haberdashery store on Whitehall, and in 1861 started a newspaper, which he called the Gate City Guardian. He fought secession, and when he was overruled, went wholeheartedly for the Confederacy, even changing the name of his paper to the Southern Confederacy. When General Nathan B. Forrest was wounded in the Battle of Chickamauga, the Adairs nursed him back to health, and George Sr. went with him to Mississippi, where he served as aide and was promoted to colonel. Colonel Adair came back to Atlanta after the war years and devoted himself to helping rebuild the practically destroyed city. As a councilman, he was instrumental in relocating the railroad terminal with his expanding service to a more spacious station and railroad yards. From there, he went into one of the most successful real estate businesses in the history of Atlanta and helped lay the foundation for a city much as it is today. His sons George and Forrest followed in the imaginative and tireless footsteps of their dad. George went with the company in 1889 when he was 16 and, like his father, devoted himself to building a modern and better Atlanta. He was interested in all welfare and civic affairs that would help his city. And it was only natural that he would throw himself wholeheartedly into any movement which promised better health and social contact with the young businessmen of his community. At 25, with many of the other charter members of AAC around the same age, he was a prime force in the organization of the club and in helping it overcome the pitfall years. His firm did a great deal of business with the Candler interests, and it was largely through his influence that Asa Candler, who was much older than Adair, put money into the rapidly growing athletic club. At George Adair's untimely death in 1921, much of his past endeavor was wrapped up in what Colonel Robert P. Jones, who was director and president of AAC over a longer period of service than any other man, said about him. He helped raise Atlanta from the status of a village to that of a city. He was a man of inspired vision. In real estate values, he was considered in Atlanta and in the Southland a final authority. Adair gave the impetus to golf in Atlanta. He organized the AAC and built a golf course at Eastlake, supervising the layout of the course until he got what he wanted, the most difficult, hazardous, and interesting golf course in the South. As Colonel Jones pointed out, George Adair was one of those responsible for the creation of our first country club at Eastlake. With its magnificent golfing holes and facilities, as well as the Capital City Club course, which followed later. At the time of his death, he was vice president of the Southern Golf Association. While he was not an original founder of the Atlanta Athletic Club, Asa G. Candler was one of the most colorful personalities that shone bright in the firmament of its early existence. When the young businessmen met to charter the club, Candler was in his late 40s and probably considered too old to be one of the athletic generation. He was, however, to be a big factor in the club's survival and growth. There is no record that he was ever included on AAC's regular membership rolls, but early in the existence of the club, he was listed as an honorary member, possibly the first of a long list of such in the history of the club. Candler was a druggist when he bought the Coca-Cola formula from John Pemberton in 1887 and organized the Coca-Cola Company in 1892. He immediately effected a wider distribution of the syrup, and by the time AAC was chartered, he was a citizen both affluent and wealthy by the standards of that day. Around the turn of the century, recognizing the possibility of Atlanta as a railroad center and hub of transportation in the Southeast, Asa Candler became involved in real estate, but in connection with the development of the city as much as with his own financial improvement. Candler had the reputation of being rather tight-fisted with his money, even to the extent of saving discarded envelopes out of the mail and stacking them on his desk as scratch paper. When, however, AAC bought property and constructed its new building on Auburn Avenue, he stood in the front line with a magnificent contribution that helped make the move and expansion possible. This was thought to be because of a number of considerations, chief among which were Candler's interest in any movement that spelled progress for Atlanta, his close friendship with Adair through business and personal connections, and the fact that he had five sons who needed both the business associations and social contacts the club had to offer. Several of these sons served one way or another in official capacities in the club, and one, Asa G. Jr., was president in the years 1915 to 1917. One interesting footnote in history concerns Asa Candler and shows the manner in which AACers faced with solid ranks any threat to their club or one of its members. Candler apparently was supporting a candidate for the job as mayor of Atlanta. Playing below the belt politics, his candidate's opponent brought up a rumored scandal in which Candler was allegedly involved in extracurricular marital affairs. The club not only united behind him, but called a meeting about it. To the members of the Atlanta Athletic Club, our attention has been called to the charges which James G. Woodward, candidate for mayor, has on several occasions made against Mr. Asa G. Candler. Mr. Candler has denied these charges in their entirety. We, the officers of the Atlanta Athletic Club, being deeply mindful of the obligation under which Mr. Candler's many kindnesses have placed us, indignantly resent this outrageous attack on his character, a private citizen running for no office. Without Mr. Candler's generous aid, the Auburn Avenue Clubhouse would never have been ours, and Eastlake would have been impossible. He has responded promptly to our every call for aid, and did so for the sole purpose of creating an institution which would be of lasting benefit to the young men of Atlanta. We believe that a corporate body should possess and show gratitude as well as an individual, and deem it our duty to acquaint every member of the Atlanta Athletic Club with Mr. Candler's generous attitude towards us, so you can repudiate with your vote such uncalled-for conduct as Mr. Woodward has been guilty of. The entire AAC membership is requested to meet at the clubhouse Tuesday afternoon at 1:45 sharp to take part in the Parade of the Maddox supporters. This was signed by G.W. Adair as president and W.H. Glenn as vice president, and by the entire board of directors. Adair and Candler were typical of the quality of leadership and inspiration which existed in AAC from its inception. Many of the names on the earliest rosters were names which have been, for the last three quarters of a century, prominent in business, civic, and social affairs in Atlanta. Some memberships in the club have been carried on for several generations and are on the club rolls today. Back then, as today, the quality of leadership was the best the city had to offer. The families of many of those young men who founded AAC had come to this budding giant of a town from other parts of the country. Others, liking what they saw, had settled here on their own initiative. Most were involved in distinguished careers. Burton Smith, AAC's first president, was born at Chapel Hill, North Carolina in 1864, where his father was a professor at the University of North Carolina and was said to be one of the most cultured citizens in the South. After the Civil War, the college at Chapel Hill was shut down as a result of Reconstruction, but the elder Smith continued to give his life to education. He went from North Carolina to Shelbyville, Tennessee, where he organized the public school system, and from there to Houston, Texas, where he also had the job of setting up a school system. Afterward, he took over the presidency of Texas State Normal School. Burton Smith graduated from the Sam Houston Normal School of Texas in 1880, then went on to the University of Georgia for his Bachelor of Philosophy degree in 1882. After his schooling at Georgia, he moved to Atlanta and entered the law offices of his brother Hoke Smith, who later became famous in Georgia politics and who went on to serve for 7 years as Secretary of the Interior under President Grover Cleveland. In his brother's office, Burton read law and was admitted to the bar the year Hoke went to his cabinet position in Washington. The younger Smith quickly gained a reputation for his ability to handle the toughest cases before a court, and many of the most important litigations in the state were placed in his hands. It is said that he won many of his cases by simple logic and plain facts, instead of by the dramatic and passionate appeals and oratory generally used in that day. He served as vice president of the American Bar Association in 1900, and in 1902 and 1903 was president of the Georgia Bar Association. Outside his business, he was prominent in social and civic affairs of Atlanta and was a dedicated church member. Lucien Lamar Knight, the historian of that era, said this about Burton Smith: his firm loyalty to his profession, his friends, and his state, his zeal as a church worker, and his firm belief that there is no such word as fail, have won him the high place he now holds as citizen and lawyer. He is easily one of Georgia's foremost men. Arnold Broyles, who was vice president under Smith from 1899 until 1903, and then succeeded him as president for two terms, was from an old family that originally settled in Virginia and was prominent in the Wars of Independence, helping to win the freedom as officers in the Revolutionary War and later in the War of 1812. From the Old Dominion, the Broyles family scattered to many parts of the nation, and Arnold's people came south. He was born at Rome in 1866 and brought to Atlanta 2 years later. He went to law school at the University of Georgia, where he was prominent in the School Athletic Association. He graduated in 1888. Broyles returned to Atlanta to practice law and became distinguished in his profession, and he got actively interested in politics. He served as an alderman for several years, was mayor pro tem in 1894, and was elected to the state legislature as representative for the term 1894 to 95. In 1900, he was elected clerk of the Superior Court of Fulton County, and he held that position for many years. When he left the club presidency in 1905, he retired from active participation as an officer in the club affairs. W.H. Glenn was our fourth president after George Adair. He was not a charter member, but joined the club and became actively interested in its affairs as a director in 1902 and 1903. He served as vice president under Adair from 1905 until 1911 and was president from 1911 through 1913. Glenn was born at Cave Springs, Georgia in 1871, came to Atlanta as a boy, and graduated from Boys High and Georgia Tech. He entered the employ of the Georgia Railway and Power Company in 1891, rose to operations manager of railways, and vice president. In 1920, he left the power company to become president of Shippers Compress Company, a firm engaged in compressing and storing cotton. He was categorized thusly by Dudley Glass in Men of Atlanta: a chap who has a host of real good friends in William Glenn. They're found among the rich and poor, old-timers and young men. He came here as a country boy. Since then, he's climbed the hill, but he has never changed a bit. He's still the same old Bill. The Atlanta Athletic Club was one of the few hobbies of J.H. Porter, and in those early years, he gave perhaps as much time to the club as any of its officials. He was a charter member, was elected to the board with its first group of officers in 1898, and remained on the board for 13 years. From 1911 to 1913, he served as vice president and was elected president for two terms from 1913 to 1915. When he turned the reins over to Asa G. Candler, Jr. Porter was born in Atlanta in 1876, received his schooling at Boys High and the University of Georgia, where he got an A.B. degree, then went on to Cornell to get his L.B.B. degree in 1897. He came back to Atlanta to practice law and soon made a mark for himself in handling big estates. He was also counsel for a number of large firms and important interests. He was a rather shy, retiring sort of fellow, never mixed in politics, but was said to be level-headed and of sound judgment. Because the club was one of his few hobbies, he was dedicated to it and did more than his fair share in any enterprise. In matters pertaining to management and operation, his advice was valued, but being modest, turned aside any plaudits. He was one of the moving forces in those early years. The caliber of its founders and those who followed in their immediate footsteps was one of the factors responsible for the recognition of AAC as one of the great athletic clubs of the nation.